1, 2, 3.
Welcome to Three Song Stories. This is the podcast that, to quote one of our earlier guests, uses music and the way it binds to memories as a truth serum to get our guests to open up and talk about their lives. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. My guest today is Stick Martin, who with Dave 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 created this show's theme song. He was raised in the backwoods of Pennsylvania and toured the country as a young kid with his parents, who worked as food vendors on the carnival circuit. At some point, he started fiddling around with drum machines and acoustic guitars, and at age 15 started writing songs and recording them onto an old tape recorder. And he started seeking out places to play his music live, and that took him to places like Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Cleveland, and eventually Florida, where he found his semi-permanent home in St. Petersburg. Stick attended Kutztown University with an intended major in music composition, but dropped out after 1.5 semesters. He says he uses, quote, looper pedals and drum machines, guitars and keyboards, and all kinds of shit so he can sound like a full band even while playing solo, and that he, quote, looks forward to the day when he's old enough to not look foolish smoking a corncob tobacco pipe. Stick was uncomfortable writing this in the third person, end quote. That being quoted, I do believe this is going to be good times. Hey there, Stick.
Good afternoon.
Pleasure to meet you.
You too. You too. Thanks for having me.
I've heard the name and I've seen your face on Facebook.
That's what faces are for.
That's what faces are for. I, too, dropped out of college after a semester and a half. So we've got some simpatico-ness right there off
the
bat.
So that was the advanced course, you know what I mean? It was so good, it only took a semester and a half.
Sort of, yeah. My first semester, I think I had a 0.75 GPA, and then I broke my leg 2 months into my second semester. So
I started off great, man. That first week and a half or so, I took things super serious, and I think really was girls didn't like me in high school very much.
Right.
And so I took a year off between high school and college, and I don't know if I just got like good enough at singing songs or whatever it was, but by the time I got to college, suddenly like girls were smiling at me, and so I was just like, was all I could think about.
So why do I have to study?
I just lost all interest.
Did you learn anything musically then that you are still applying to your world now, or did you really not get anything out of that?
No, I had one class. It was literally just like a hand percussion class, and that really taught me, like, you can have like three or four really simple layers doing really, really repetitive things, but if they fit together creatively, I mean, that's where the alchemy is. You know what I mean? You're getting so much more out of these four separate parts. You know, but. And just the simplicity of breaking it down to just drums made it easy to understand. You're not worried about all these different notes or chords or harmony. But that is gigantic. I mean, that to this day I still use all the time.
So let's talk for a little bit about your life I don't want to say as a carny, around carnies anyway.
It's definitely a carny. definitely a carny.
Is there a language that goes along with that?
A little bit.
Somebody asked me to ask you that.
Yeah. I guess this is like the great grifters too use this, but like marks
right.
is like any just a regular person at the carnival that walks up to a game and they think, hey, I got a shot at winning this. You know what I mean? So kind of the object of the scam, I guess, is a mark.
So what did your folks sell?
They sold lots and lots and lots of stuff. They were actually the cookhouse, which means that they, you know, when the carnival was open, they sold hamburgers and hot dogs and, you know, French fries and everything. But even when the carnival was closed, they were kind of like the restaurant for all the people that worked on the carnival. So they were open probably, I don't know, 6 in the morning doing eggs and bacon and stuff
like that. Was that fun times for you? Or was that kind of a hassle? Did you not know? And did you have context enough to know that this is like an adventure? Or was this just
no?
A drag?
Yeah, I thought at the time I think it was the perfect age for it. I mean, I did it. I don't know. I was probably like 11 or 12, something like that. So it's like riding carnival rides, you know, 5 months out of the year or something like that. And there was like a couple other families out there that had kids about my age, and we all hung out. And I still talk to some of those kids today, like Kelly Michaels and. Dan Ketchum, kids that I, you know, just hung out, ran around carnivals.
How far did you guys travel? How big was the circuit?
Mostly like southern Pennsylvania and a little bit of upstate New York. Sometimes half the carnivals come to Florida for, you know, the cold parts of the year or whatever. But
does that make you more or less likely to eat carnival food now if you go to a carnival?
Every once in a while I'll miss it. Like I want to get like a funnel cake or something. Yeah. You know what
Elephant
I mean?
Ear.
Yeah, yeah. Fried dough is what my parents called it. Just fried dough.
So you get a hankering for it sometimes?
No, I think I eat it out of a tradition. I think
you got to suffer
it's
through
instantly
it one more
regrettable.
Time.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a giant piece of dough, deep fried
with
powdered sugar. Yeah, yeah, you don't like. I don't know.
Oh, music as a kid. That seems like an interesting scene. There was probably some musicians around that. Was there? What was your musical background as a kid?
It's weird. The carnival thing. It was mostly. Like a lot of like country acts and some like sometimes you get like 1950s reviews and stuff like that. And I hated it all at the time. Like if I was like, you know, 10, 11 years old, I there was nothing more lame to me than country music. But it kind of gets in there. You know what I mean? It's like in your DNA, even if you didn't want it to be.
Oh, yeah.
But there was other than – I mean, me and my brother and stuff, we were into like hip-hop and breakdance music and stuff
what
like that.
What year would this have been when you were on the circuit as a 10-year-old, say?
Jeez, probably 87, 88, something like that. And, you know, I mean, it was weird time to get into, you know, my family kind of stopped doing it, I guess, when I was like maybe 13 or 14, somewhere around there. And then kind of became more of a normal small town life.
Gotcha. What was your first instrument?
My first instrument was, I guess, snare drum. Or maybe, probably before that I had like a little synthesizer. I think some guy owed my dad money and gave him a synthesizer that I ended up with. Yeah, yeah, I didn't know how to play it.
Did your folks play music? Did you have music being played around you?
Not really. My mom played a little bit piano or tried to. I learned as an adult, but she didn't get very far with it or whatever. But she loved music. They listened to a lot of music.
What was being played around the house?
My dad was just like a doo-wop guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's weird. He should have been kind of his age. He should have been like a hippie 60s kid.
Yeah,
he grew up with his uncles. So he listened to the stuff that like, you know, the generation before him listened to. It was like lots of doo-wop, Drifters, Platters, stuff like that. My mom was a little bit more, you know, Zeppelin and kind of the late 60s, early 70s. You know, rock stuff.
Did they have records? Were they spinning records at the house? Was it radio play?
Eight
tracks, maybe.
It was like oldies radio was what we would cruise. Like I remember just like driving on cross country on vacation, and it'd just be like oldies radio from place to place to place. So it was mostly what I heard, I guess, growing up.
What's your earliest musical memory? If you try to leap back as far as possible,
I think it's. Like a frog singing You Are My Sunshine on The Muppet Show.
Oh.
I think
a
like,
frog or the frog?
I don't know if it was Kermit or not, because like the guys had like, you know, they had your side frogs, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
They had, you know, we can't all be Kermits. All right. It's like there's no small parts, just small frogs, right? That's
the, like the shark, right?
But you know what I mean? I don't know. It might have been like not one of the main characters.
Seems like you would have remembered it being Kermit if it was Kermit.
Yeah, but I can barely remember it. And I think my mom probably sang it too. I think everybody's mom sings You Are My Sunshine, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But that's way back in there, you know, some of the first stuff I can remember.
Huh. Where did the name Monkey House Studio come from?
Excuse me. There's a... my favorite author is Kurt Vonnegut.
I was wondering if
yeah,
there was
and
a Vonnegut connection.
He has a collection of short stories.
I know that collection of short stories.
And it's not even like my favorite work of his or anything, but I just like the idea of like the collection of short stories. Like that's kind of what a studio becomes after a while. And I, you know, so that's what I think there's another Monkey House Studio someplace in the U.S. or whatever. I don't know. At some point, maybe that guy will sue me.
Yeah, maybe you sue them.
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of stuff do you record there typically?
Lots of different stuff. I do a decent amount of hip hop, just because there's a billion rappers, and a lot of times it's really, really fast. A lot of times they'll come in with a beat they've already paid for, and the beat's already together, and they just lay down rap vocals, and you can, you know, finish three or four songs in a night. It's just super, super fast. Then I do like a lot of singer-songwriter-y stuff. A lot of guys that you know, they kind of play acoustic and they sing and they write some stuff, but they don't really like have a full band behind them. So I'll do the drum tracks, bass tracks, whatever, backup vocals, and try to make them sound like a group.
What all do you play?
Mostly, you know, guitar, but I'm a pretty good drummer. Not a bad bassist. I'm okay at keys.
Are you the drummer on our theme song?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we did like a drum loop And then I'm playing the fills live on a drum kit, you know, some stuff like that. Sometimes we'll mix, you know, formats like that when we record drums.
Cool. I was wondering if that was a live drum or if you use a drum machine or whatever.
I mean, it's a digital kit that fires, you know, samples or whatever.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, you still got to sit over there with the sticks or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so real quick back to the you said the hip-hop people will come in with a beat that they already bought. So is this like a market out there where people create beats and then put them on a marketplace that people
absolutely.
Buy them? This is kind of a world that I don't really know about.
No, it's weird. It's not really my thing either. I mean, I prefer to build the beats up ourselves. But some of these guys, they just all they do is they sit around and they make, you know, hip hop beats. And a lot of the stuff's kind of cookie cutter where it's like it's 16 bars a verse and there's going to be 8 bars a chorus. And then 16 bars a verse and 8 bars a chorus. So it's almost like guys start to write in that format. And then there's, you know, thousands of songs that'll actually fit those lyrics and chorus like right over what they've written. Like I said, it gets to be a little bit cookie cutter, and it's weird. I think it's something where if you pay a certain amount, you get to use their beat. If you pay a larger amount, you get to use that beat exclusively, and they can no longer sell it to anybody else. But it's not really something I'm deep into. It's just something that, like, I'm on the
fringe
of.
Yeah, you're being exposed to it,
yeah.
Basically. Interesting. That's kind of a new concept to me. So there's been a resurgence in musicians wanting to put out their stuff on vinyl or on tape or whatever. Do you help facilitate that, or, you know, do you just turn it over to them digitally and then it's up to them?
Yeah, for the most part. I used to work with a record label, Crafty Records, out of New York City, and they would do just weird vinyl pressings, like the same single but 3 different color vinyl, and these punk rock collectors would. But it's weird. Sometimes I would just like do the mastering for the vinyl or something. You know what I mean? I'd just be involved in some way. I respect that stuff, you know, but to me it's like I'm a digital kid. It's also – it's a little bit like stamp collecting where it's just like, man, I've got – Spotify on my phone in a in my pocket, and there's just millions upon millions of songs, and I don't know, there's something about vinyl that can't touch that to me, you know.
Yeah,
it's always with me.
So
it's
that, like, how you listen mostly, like Spotify or something like that?
Yeah, probably. I'd say Spotify's where I listen to most stuff.
What about compression? You know, some people are like, "Ooh, I like it because it's vinyl and it's wave." You know, it's analog, and then you've got the MP3s, and then there's the high bit rate MP3s.
No, and there, I mean, there's
you're not
something
hung up
to
on that.
That for sure. But I also feel like, I mean, there's like a Creedence record was created specifically to go on a piece of vinyl back in the day.
Right.
And when you put that on, it sounds like they nailed it. You know what
I
mean?
Yeah,
it's
that
sounds about how. But then there's other stuff today that's. I mean, it's purely intended as a digital to be listened to digitally.
It's being produced the whole way through digitally,
and
it's being heard the whole way through by the producers.
That's
digitally.
Part of it too. If I record something in Pro Tools and then dump that onto a piece of vinyl, I mean, you're listening to it in analog, but it's not really analog.
Yeah.
I mean, it has to be recorded to tape. You know what I mean?
Like,
so it's even sometimes when stuff ends up on vinyl, it doesn't have that old school analog sound.
That makes so much sense. I'm a photographer, and I bridged the gap from, you know, film to digital, and so I think a lot about that analog digital divide and how we're going back and forth across it. And what you just said makes perfect sense. It's like if you're going to do the whole thing digitally and then press it to vinyl. It's kind of not the same thing.
No, it's almost like it's just as bad as, you know, like the old, like the 80s, the 1980s Beatles CDs, where they didn't really know how to do mastering of CDs yet. So there was like a generation of people that grew up with this awful sounding Beatles music. You know, Beatles did most of like their stuff was in mono. And so like there's these weird stereo mixes where they didn't really understand stereo
yet. Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's one of those things of like, you know, if it's created digitally, I mean, some of this stuff is done completely with a set of headphones on. And it's like they really hope that you listen to it through a set of good headphones. You know, I mean, I think that stuff's great, but just kind of depends what you're going for.
Well, let's move on to your first song. What do you got?
I think it was Freedom of 76,
mm-hmm.
right? Yes, a Ween song. Ween is probably my favorite band. I know Dave. I think that's how I met Dave.
Yeah, I was just about to say, that seems like that's probably a simpatico moment there, too.
We met each other, and then we got invited. I think I played a gig, and there was like an after party. And Dave and I ended up at this after party. We had a ween off where he would play a ween song.
A ween off.
See, you know, and we figured out maybe this, you know, maybe this guy's got 10, 11 songs. I easily got 10, 11 songs. And I think we were like 35, 40 songs deep and the sun is coming up.
How big was the audience for this?
By the end of it, like two people. I think it was me and Dave and the girl that had a crush on me or whatever. But at the beginning of it, everybody was into it. But I think it got to the point where like everybody was like, yeah, I think both of these guys know about 50 ween songs. This could go all day. I think we just ran out of gas. I think he still had plenty of songs. But it was kind of we knew we were going to be friends after that. But yeah, just I want to do that again, actually.
Okay, so we turned that into a live album. what song is this?
Freedom of 76 is a ween song about the city of Philadelphia. And when I was 16, 17, my older brother moved to Philly. And I was from like this really, really small town, and it was just night and day difference. There was culture and, you know, really, really good local music and really, really good, like, you know, world famous bands that were stopping in Philly. Nobody was stopping in, you know, my small town to play. And I just remember every time I would drive to Philadelphia, right, we'd come over this one hill, we'd play this song, and you'd almost see like the buildings grow, you know what I mean? And just, I don't know, for maybe 2 or 3 years, every time we drove to Philly, we'd play the song as soon as we hit the city. And it just brings me back to that, you know, I mean, I still love Philadelphia. I still love that place.
Cool. Well, let's hear it. This is Freedom of 76 from Ween's 1994 album Chocolate and Cheese. You're listening to Three Song Stories. It's biography through music. Our director was rocking it out in the booth. normally I would say something like, how often do you listen to Ween these days? But it sounds like if it's your favorite band, you're probably constantly still. I mean, are they still together?
Technically. They went on hiatus, and now they still do a lot of shows. I don't think they've got any, like, albums planned or anything like that. I think they had some... addiction issues in the band a little bit. You know, it happens from time to time.
Yeah, it's a rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah. But their guitar player now just goes by Dean Ween. He's releasing records. He released like two in the last year. I mean, just dropping records left and right. Build himself a studio, and they just record constantly. So
you ever met him or them?
I've met him outside of shows and stuff a handful of times. I mean, just sugar, hey, love you guys. Nice to meet you. I've never, you know, chilled with him or anything, but yeah.
Who would you like to record if you could pick anybody to record, you know, as a producer?
Wow. Definitely, you know, probably guys like Beck. I really like, I mean, I'd do any of the guys from Ween. Some of maybe old hip hop stuff like De La Soul. I'd love to have like De La Soul in my studio. Or have like Dr. Dre. I'd love to just like hang out while Dr. Dre recorded something just to see how that guy, like, you know, his workflow, his process or whatever. Producers from the 90s called the Dust Brothers that were real big for, I don't know, 3-4 years or something. And I always loved everything they put out.
Have you got to spend time in other people's studios to see how the process works for other people? Or have you kind of just invented it all yourself in your own place?
No, there was a guy in Pennsylvania named Rich Resigno, and he owns a place called Mountainside Studios. It's in Tobyhanna, Pennsylvania, and he was maybe 40 when I was 20, and he owned the studio, and it was, I mean, he knew what he was doing. This guy was a pro. And then probably the first 3-4 years after I'd opened my studio, I called that guy once a week. It was like, hey, man, every time I talk
to
the mic,
I got a new problem I need to solve.
It comes out of the headphones 2 seconds later. What am I, you know, I mean, just anything that you had a question about, he knew an answer to. And I'd recorded with him a couple of times. And the first time I went in there, like you go into a studio the first time, the guy's like, oh, what kind of kick drum sound do you want? I have no idea what you're talking about, man.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I've heard drums, but I didn't, you know. He's like, well, do you like this or do you like that? And I'm like, ah, they both sound exactly the same,
yeah,
dude.
I can't hear the difference.
Yeah,
yet.
Yeah.
Can you hear the difference these days?
I mean, absolutely. Sure. But like, I mean, so the first couple times you're in there, it just seems like random nonsense. But maybe the third time I worked with that guy, I knew enough where I was like, oh, so this is what he's doing with kick drums. And you know what I mean?
Yeah,
where a lot
yeah.
of it made sense. But I mean, that was like me going to college. It was just like working with that guy. He knew there was no question that he didn't have an answer to. And a lot of the stuff, there's different techniques. He's like, well, this is how I do it, but a lot of other guys do it this way or that way or whatever. But just brilliant. Just a brilliant dude. Super smart, super helpful. Could explain things in ways I could understand.
You got any younger proteges that maybe you're helping along now that you've got more experience?
There are a couple of kids that come and work in my studio. And I mean, like kids like late teens. Maybe early 20s. There's a kid by the name of Patience Totten. You can find all these kids on Facebook or, you know,
Instagram.
I'm sure there are 8 billion places.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kayla Corpix is another girl. They just flew her out to LA. She's talking to record labels and stuff. Now I think she's going to do something real, real big. Just likable. It doesn't matter what kind of music you like. Just like, but she starts to sing, and you go, "Oh, I'm going to sit here and watch this for an hour." You know.
Cool.
There's also this guy I work with, John Jacobs, who is a relatively well-known like Tampa comedian, and we just put out a comedy record that's
really
40 songs long. They're all like 30 seconds to maybe a minute and 20. You know what I mean?
Really?
Real, real short, 40 seconds. Like there's 6 or 7 songs about McDonald's on there. Just like unplanned. You didn't realize, you know, it wasn't part of the plan of the record till we got to the end. Like, you talk a lot about McDonald's, bro. Like just. But yeah, that stuff I love. And it kind of has like a TV theme song quality to it.
You know,
I'm part of it because they're just short.
Sort of jingly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love that stuff. I love TV. Like growing up, TV jingles to me were legit.
What's a theme song to a TV show that you can sing on command?
I mean, Monsters is an instrumental, but it's like surfy Dracula music, you know what I mean? Like, that's amazing.
Anything else?
I
just love this because I've asked this question to quite a few people, and mostly they're like, man, you know, Golden Girls maybe. But you're
Golden
just
Girls,
like, you're just
oh,
like
no, yeah, I, got, I probably got all the lyrics to Golden Girls, all the lyrics to at least the opening theme of Gilligan's Island.
Mm-hmm.
The ending theme had like different words that I don't have memorized, but I like when TV shows like Lancelot Link, Secret Chimp was one I loved, right? Lancelot Link, Secret Chimp. I loved when theme songs like told you the setup of the show,
yeah,
Brady Bunch, they let you know what was going on. You could, yeah, I don't know. I miss that.
It seems like you could do a whole album of fake TV theme songs.
I'd be amazed if somebody hasn't.
That's probably true.
There's a guy that put out a record called For Those About to Shop, and I think it's like 60 jingles for fake products, just like fried chicken. And it's just, you know. But I love stuff like that. It was, to me, like, that music is legitimate as Pink Floyd or you know, it's not trying to be Pink Floyd. It you know, and when it does what it's supposed to do, it gets stuck in your brain, you know.
Well, you know, and this is great to circle back around to our theme song, which, you know, we have gotten so much positive feedback to it. I think you really, you know, applied a lot of that exuberance in your musicality and your way you produce things to how that all turned out.
It definitely sounds like it's fun. It definitely sounds like we had fun recording it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Me and Dave were driving down. We talked about how, like, there's certain times, like, you won't like a song – not because it didn't turn out good, but it was like difficult when you were working on it. Be like, oh, that song was a pain in the ass. You know what I mean? So you have like a weird relationship when you're working on it, but that song was a blast. It didn't take us long. It only took us a few hours.
Yeah, it was great because all I did was just send Dave. I'm like, okay, we want to have some sort of thing that riffs on this. It'll go at the beginning of that. He messaged me back like an hour later and he's like, I'm thinking guitar, ukulele, mouth harp, and kazoo. And I showed Richard that email. He's like, perfect.
And it's got the jaw harp thing.
Yeah. Okay. What was the first music that you physically owned yourself as a kid?
I know this. Like, I give you the first four, all right?
Okay.
Footloose soundtrack, all right? Fantastic, all right? Don't kid yourself. It's one of the greats.
Do you like the movie?
Yeah,
see,
all right.
The movie, I don't really jive with the movie. There's too much dancing.
I don't know. It's, you know, I punch dance sometimes when I'm mad, you know.
But Footloose?
Footloose soundtrack, Ghostbusters soundtrack. I just, when I was a kid, I saw a movie.
Yeah,
I
you
just,
were like, the right age for that.
But I feel like the first real records I got were Raisin' Hell by Run DMC. And then the next one's Big Lizard in My Backyard by the Dead Milkmen. And it was like the first real records. And one was like just really good old school hip hop. The other one was like comedy kind of punk music a little bit. And that's like, to this day, is still like hip hop kind of stuff.
That rounds it all out for
you.
That's
for
like,
sure,
you
for
boil
sure.
It down.
I loved stuff that was weird and funny.
Do you think you loved it because of who you were going to turn out to be? Or do you think you turned out to be who you are because you listened to it? Or, you know, where's the chicken and the egg here?
There's definitely, like, especially with Dead Milkmen, like, they sounded like guys that were, like, 4 years older than I was. And, like, it wasn't recorded very well.
Yeah.
So it was, like, one of those things where, like, hey, maybe that's something I could do. Like, you liked it because, you know, like, in the 80s, like, there were professional rock stars. And it was so lame. And, like, I mean, just even as, like a 5 or 6 year old kid, just I'd see these guys with teased hair that, like, I don't know, just blow drying your hair for 45 minutes didn't feel like rock and roll to me. You know what I mean? It just, yeah. You know, Poison and just all of those bands. So then I heard this stuff. It was just like so goofy and just, I mean, some of it is stupid. Some of it is so immature and in really poor taste. But I loved it. I think that's part of why I liked it too. It was, you knew, like, you were giggling at stuff that you weren't supposed to be giggling about, you know?
Mixtapes. Where'd they fit into your childhood?
Big mixtape guy. So my dad's kind of a psycho. He was like a Vietnam Marine. And so it just was like, yeah, he could blow his top at any moment. So I learned to just stay out of his way, and I would hide in the basement and make mixtapes.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
What was your method? Were you recording them off the radio? You probably may have had a double cassette thing going.
Yeah, real early. I remember there was this, like, every morning they would do funny songs, like, yeah, Fish Heads and There's a Bathroom on the Right, weird
fish
parodies.
Heads,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow, that's
roly
deep memory. That's a real deep memory.
It took him to the movies. So I didn't have to buy a ticket to get him in. Like, this, this stuff's amazing to me. I couldn't believe it was, like, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know, like, somebody paid money to make this. Like, a team of people went in and created Fish Heads, you know? I was just, like, amazed by that stuff. Early Weird Al was, you know, just thought it was—
You ever seen Weird Al?
Yeah, I have seen him once in concert. It's amazing.
Seen him. I've heard he's the most amazing live show that you can see.
He looks great. Like, yeah. He's a vegan. Yeah. And so he's
going to outlive us all.
Dude, he looks fantastic. He looks like he did in 1983.
He's going to be making satirical versions of songs 50 years from now.
No, yeah, I love it. His last album, that the day it came out, was the number one record, finally. It was like he had like some 15 album deal or whatever that he signed 25 years ago or something.
So did you ever make mixtapes for chicks that you wanted to impress?
Oh, for sure, man. I'll still make a playlist once in a while.
You know? Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So, like a playlist like on Spotify, how does that work? See, because I don't really know the way they
Same thing. I mean, it's basically a mixtape, but you can throw it together.
But you can like send someone a link and it will play a certain number of songs in order? Is that?
Yeah. I mean, you can design it.
Not to sound like an old dude here. But.
No, but it's just like I remember when I was first doing mixtapes. Like, you had to sit there for the length of the song. So if it was like, I remember when like 120-minute tapes came out, brother were like, oh my God, 120 minutes? I couldn't imagine being able to hold more music than 120 minutes at any one time. Because that was more than CDs. That was more than, what I mean? But they were all, it was like really low quality tape. And they would, like all the beginnings and the end of the tape would all be stretched out a little bit. The song would kind of ooze in because the tape quality was so low. But it's weird. I would make 10 different mixtapes that had most of the same songs on it, just reordered a lot of the time. Yeah.
They were ordered in a reason. You had logic in your brain.
The thing about a tape, too, you had the A side and the B side. Mm-hmm. So you had an A side opener and an A side closer and a B side opener and a B side closer.
It's like a double album.
No way. But then the CD kind of changed that dynamic a little bit.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, you still kind of have that, but I always feel like you put out like a 15-song album. Like, is anybody listening to songs like 11, 12, and 13? Does anybody ever make it that deep anymore,
What about the idea that, people used to make records that had an arc? Like professional bands would make an album that told a story. Nowadays, everybody's listening to stuff piecemeal. Do you think that they were losing something there because of that as a producer?
Well, I think the real gel to albums, when you're talking 50s, Sun Studio stuff, was you could have a guy come in, do 5 originals, 5 covers, slow songs, fast, maybe this one's a waltz, this one's country, but same group of guys in the same room or two, there was only maybe one guitar amp. There was probably one bass around. And so it was like one piano. And so just the fact that you had these 10 songs performed on the same set of instruments and stuff like that. I feel like that made a record. It really tied it together. Even before we kind of had these intentional
storytelling
themes and what I mean? Some of that stuff. Because a lot of the stuff
that's an interesting,
it holds, there's a lot of theme albums that the first 3 songs hold together pretty good. Even Sgt. Pepper starts to get into some territory. You're not sure as how it's connected or it's very loosely connected to a live show or, but so this, that idea, and now it's so weird. You put out an album and the kick drum sound is crazily different track to track to track to track to track, where you just kind of had these simple things that kind of glued everything together and held it together. And now it's people are like, oh, record this track in LA. And then I flew over here and recorded this in a completely different place. And so it's I feel like we've lost that. I feel like we've lost the same couple of guys, and usually over the same, day or a couple of days or a couple of weeks or whatever, so it was a group of guys in a specific era. And, and so even that stuff to me is what really made the albums of when we were growing up. Especially anything hip hop or electronic, where everything was just hey, this drum machine came out last summer, so this is what music sounds like now. And then till the new drum machine comes out, and now, that's the new sound. So I kind of miss that. I kind of miss that. You'd have a group of songs glued by the technology, I guess.
I love that. One of my closing songs for an episode we just recently released was a song by Ani DeFranco. You know her?
Sure.
And the reason I played it was because I quoted a line to Richard in the studio the other day during a show. People used to make records as in a record of an event of people playing music in a room. And I thought, oh, that's such a great line. And that's what you're talking about.
Yeah,
that's to you, that's a real record.
Well, I love the 70s stuff where guys really, I feel like Pink Floyd really picked it up and ran with it hard.
They were going to go for concepts. Level, right.
But those were some of the best players in the world, in the best studios in the world, with the best engineers in the world, with the newest of new technology and guys that knew how to work that tech. You know what I mean? And that's why I love like that, like the Dark Side to Wall run. There's just like those 3-4 records that are perfect to me. And I love everything they do, but I just feel like that's when it was just a peak that they held for like 7 years or something. Yeah. It's an amazing... I think Dark Side, Wish You Were Here, Animals, and Wall are just, and I mean, I love Piper at the Gates of Dawn. I love the goofy stuff, but.
Yeah, but I agree with those four albums.
Yeah, just perfection in sound and in playing. And it was just, you know, the infighting was kept
it's a miracle, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, we're moving on to song two. What do you got?
What was song two? Let's see. That's, a Sunday Morning Coming Down, right? Yeah, yeah, which is just like, I said before when I was a kid, I thought country was so lame. I just thought it was – and 80s country is pretty lame if, you know, we're being – there's not a ton of 80s stuff that's great. But I lived in the Bronx, and I would go to this bar called the City Island Pub. And at 4 a.m., they would just, like, lock the door. And if you were one of the cool guys, you just kept hanging out in the bar. And we would just drink whiskey. And it was, like, just nothing but Johnny Cash on the jukebox. And Sunday Morning Coming Down. Didn't have to be Sunday. It could be any morning. But the sun is coming up and just you and your loser buddy still drinking in a bar. And that song would come on. And I was like, oh, man, I get it now. I get Johnny Cash now. Like
I have a memory of this song back in the early days with Dave downtown when we were running a bar down there and all of us getting up at 2 in the afternoon to go to get breakfast and this song playing. And
It's so sad beyond like the words and the music. It's one of those things that Johnny Cash can do where it's like this ache that is just present no matter what the words he's singing, man. And he does it a lot, but this song to me is just, you know, hits it so hard.
All right, we're going to hear it. This is Sunday Morning Coming Down, performed by Johnny Cash from his Folsom Prison album. You're listening to Three Song Stories.
Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head. That didn't hurt. And the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert. Then I fumbled in my closet, threw my clothes and found my cleanest dirty shirt. Then I washed my face and combed my hair and stumbled down the stairs to meet the day. I'd smoked my mind the night before with cigarettes and songs I'd been picking. But I lit my first and watched a small kid playing with a can that he was kicking. Then I walked across the street and caught the Sunday smell of someone's frying chicken. And Lord, it took me back to something that I lost somewhere, somehow along the way. On a Sunday morning sidewalk, I'm wishing, Lord, that I was stoned. There's something in a Sunday that makes a body feel alone. And there's nothing sure to die in that's half as lonesome as the sound of the sleeping city sidewalk. And Sunday morning coming down. In the park I saw a daddy with a laughing little girl that he was swinging. And I stopped beside a Sunday school and listened to the songs they were singing. Then I headed down the streets and somewhere far away a every bell was ringing. And it echoed through the canyons like a disappearing dreams of yesterday. On a Sunday morning sidewalk, I'm wishing, Lord, that I was stoned. 'Cause there's something in a Sunday that makes a body feel alone. And there's nothing short of dying that's half as lonesome as the sound of the sleeping city sidewalk. And Sunday morning coming down.
Isn't it amazing how great that sounds for a live recording?
I bet they clapped like another 15 minutes.
Did you know, or maybe you, I don't know, you probably know, I didn't know this until I looked it up to find it for this show, that Kris Kristofferson wrote that song?
I didn't know that, but those guys did, you know, each other's songs all the time.
Yeah, he wrote it. Johnny Cash recorded it first, but then he recorded it, and there's like a John Denver recording of it, and there's like a Willie Nelson recording of it.
Well, it's funny, when you said it was from the Folsom record, I knew that's a live record, but I think I know it from a best of, but it was still this version, and I didn't even realize it was a live version until the end there, where like you heard the applause.
I also found another version that was live from the Czech Republic, I think, from like 1983 or something. But it didn't nearly have the same, you know what I mean? I was like, oh, maybe I'll play that one. But then I played it and I'm like, this is the one that you're talking about.
I've got like a four or five song album of Johnny Cash, like doing like Folsom Prison and Walk the Line and stuff, but just all in German. He's just singing it in German. He doesn't speak German. So I think he's just like singing it phonetically a line at a time.
That's got to be weird.
It's super weird. Nobody likes it but me.
You put that on late at night at a party, people think they lost their minds.
it's pretty strange.
Are we all having a stroke? What's going on?
Well, it's weird too. It never really translates. When you take a song from one language and do it another language, there's always something lost. 99 Red Balloons or whatever. It doesn't always,
Wow, there's another one I haven't thought of in a while. Okay, what are albums or an album that you will always want to listen to every track on? And you can't say Pink Floyd because we've already discussed that.
Yeah. And they are definitely up there. Let's see. Probably Paul's Boutique by the Beastie Boys.
Okay.
It just flows. A lot of the songs don't make a lot of sense out of context. Some of them are pretty short, like interlude-y stuff. You know what I mean? So it's just, you know, just hear, you know, some 45-second thing come in where it's just like the Beastie Boys going, woo, over like weird bluegrass. You're like, what the hell is this? But like in the album, I don't know. It all makes sense. So, but that album's great. That album's fantastic.
Do you ever listen to music you have recorded yourself, your music? Or do you, once you've put it out there, it's for other people. It's not for you.
No, I still go back and listen to it. It takes a couple of years before
Gotta get some distance.
Yeah, because, I mean, for like a year after, I'm like, the hi-hat's too loud on the bridge. I'm so nitpicky about everything. But then after a while, you just start to hear it as songs again, and that's when I start to really like it. And sometimes if I get depressed or whatever, I'll like put on something that like I know I was proud of, like I did something okay, you know. But I've always been like an album guy. I'm not usually like the live version guy. I mean, there's certain bands I like to go see live because they jam or whatever, but for the most part I like album stuff. I like that. No, let's do it in the studio and plan it out and record it right. And, you know, so the album version to me is usually like the version of whatever it is.
How many songs have you written?
Maybe 140, 150, something like that.
They still all up in the noodle there?
No, there was I think when I was like 90 or 100, I could keep track of all of them. But over the years, some of the keepers feel less like keepers. You know what I mean? Like, oh, I don't know. I thought it was good for a summer. But so it's weird. Some songs I don't really like that much anymore, but somebody along the way told me that they loved it. So you feel like, I guess I better keep that one around. I don't know.
you know, the engine of this show is the way music will fuse into a memory in a moment. Have you ever thought about music that you've set out there into the world doing that to somebody else?
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully. I've had a handful of people, not a lot, you know, maybe a half a dozen over 25 years that came up and said, like, that song that you wrote is my favorite song I've ever heard. Like, it just, you know, I mean, once every 5 years I hear that. It's not very much. But, I mean, that's amazing to me. That blows me away. Even just if you just play a song that you wrote and you look out and somebody is mouthing the words back at you. It's insane.
But, you know, it may not even be that they like a song. No offense. But that, you know, your song is playing when they kissed their future wife for the first time.
Yeah, suddenly.
You know, whether they like it or not, if you put that song on, they'd just be like, oh, I'm back there, you know?
It's crazy
how music does that. And as I don't make music for the public to hear, so I can't even comprehend what that must be like. But it's got to be interesting.
It's so strange because there are people that play music that just – they sit in their bedroom and they play an hour a night, you know, a fiddle or a banjo or something, and they never intend to like, hey, let's go be in a band and play at the local bar. That's just not – you know, and it's weird to me. It's almost a more pure form of it because you're playing music to play music. You know what I mean? I definitely have the like, hey, everybody look at me. I want attention thing, you know, a lot when I was growing up. I mean, that's definitely part of why I wanted to be in bands and stuff like that, as I did. I wanted to perform for people. But it is like its own other animal, you know? I mean, I know great performers that aren't really great musicians, and I know great musicians that don't like to play in front of people.
I wouldn't claim to be a great musician on any level, but I play my ukulele every day and have for years and have no intention of playing it in front of anybody else. So I kind of fall into that category in some strange way.
It's this thing of – I think as I get older, I get more and more into that, where I don't care.
It's like meditation for me or something. I don't know, because it's the way your brain has to work to make it all happen is just something
– I feel like it's –
escapist about it.
Your brain is this rubber band, and over time you get to stretch it out a little bit, and music is just a great activity to fill up. Like, all right, this is literally taking about 99% of my brain power to just keep track of what my fingers are doing.
Well,
I'm trying to sing.
And you get to see these little pivots of forward progress where something that was taking 99% now doesn't even take any percent because
somehow it's
in there. And you're like, whoa, I can –
The muscle memory is taking over.
I can free up my brain to do other things
now. I can think about how much I hate myself again.
Oh,
thank God.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness for that. Are you a DJ too?
Like
spinning records for people, or am I mistaken on that front?
Not really. I mean, I kind of I'll create mixes and stuff. Like I did break mixes where I was just going to do like a playlist that lasted about 20 minutes. So, you know, when the band went on break, I could still kind of have some control of the mood of the room. And then it just started getting carried away. Well, maybe we could beat match all the songs. So as one song, you know, eases into the other, like it's still – and then like it ended up taking me like 2 weeks to make one 20-minute playlist because there's elements of the first song are now mixed into the last song.
Right, yeah, because you've got so much context in it that nobody else is even probably noticing.
No, and at 15 minutes, there'd be like a police siren, and that would like let everybody in the band know you have 5 minutes. Like go take a pee, go get your drink, get on stage and tune your bass. Yeah, just weird stuff like that. But I get carried away. But I definitely don't go out to like clubs and spin
okay,
records
so yeah, you're
or
not,
anything.
Gotcha. If you could be on stage with any band, I guess you're probably going to say Ween, right? And play with them like a play a set in front of a huge crowd, and let's expand it to any band ever, even if they're no longer around.
Ooh. Let's see. Honestly, I mean, I love Ween. I might say like a band like War, though, just because like no matter what that band plays, it's so much fun. Everybody's singing most of the time. Like, I don't know. I love that. I love all the like the percussion and stuff to bands like that. It's just so much fun. It's the type of thing where like you get set down your guitar and dance. Just dance along with the rest of the band for 5 minutes and then pick it back up. But like everybody's just doing something really, really small. I don't know. Looks like fun.
Craziest concert experience or maybe favorite concert experience. Do you have like you said you don't really like – you said you're more of an album guy, but –
Yeah, I mean I go to a lot of shows, especially when I was younger. Now it's tough because I book my band out. Like I try to book out 3-4 months and then like shows get announced about a month and a half. So I got to kind of cancel something to do something else. But geez, favorite concert experience or craziest – I can talk freely about substance use.
Right? We're a podcast.
I was seeing Nine Inch Nails and David Bowie in I think in Philadelphia. I think at the Spectrum. I think at the Spectrum. Yeah, yeah. And I was buying LSD outside of the concert, and my friend Chris saw me. Buying it, you know, he was like kind of with our group, and just to mess with me, he walked up behind me and said, "Put your hands on the car," right, like a cop would. "Hey, put your hands in the car," and so I just took all of the LSD that I bought and put it in my mouth and like ate it, because I thought I was gonna get arrested, so I didn't want to have.
You were
any...
taking eight for the team.
No, yeah, I didn't. Well, I didn't. I mean, it was such a reaction. I didn't think about it. It was not like they could be like, "What were you thinking?" I have no idea. My body just did this, and I just swallowed it. And so then, like, I turned around. It was my buddy. I wasn't in any trouble, but it was, you know, 45 minutes before the concert started. And, I mean, I was, you know, probably out of my mind for a day and a half or something. Yeah.
They were carting you around, and the world was turning into colored grids.
No. I mean, it was a great show. It was, you know. I was the only time I ever saw David Bowie, too, so I was super glad I got to see that.
And do you remember seeing him?
Yeah. I mean, I still have, you know, I usually retain that stuff, right?
So when was the last time you bought music that had a physical form, like a CD or an album or a tape?
Jesus.
Something that wasn't streamed to your device.
I think... like the last time I went to a store and bought a record was Wero by Beck in like 2005 or something. I've probably bought like local CDs or something off of some local band. Yeah, but the last time I was like, I think I went to a Sam Goody. Maybe I don't know, that might be a lie. I don't know. Sam Goody may have closed 10 years before. I went to some store in a mall that I'm sure can't be open anymore. And like walked in and bought it, and it had the plastic anti-theft thing on it, you know what I mean? Just, it was such a weird format.
You know, it's so weird. I had to get my tire fixed the other day, so I dropped my car off at the Sears Tire Center. So I had some time to kill, so I walked into our local mall. Hadn't been in there for a while. And they had they're still a record store in there. You know, like 3,000-4,000 square feet with CDs and stuff. And there was just one guy standing in the entrance. He was the employee. And there was no one in there. And I just walked by and I thought, what on earth is that happening for?
I guess somebody's
buying
a lot of
some.
Used vinyl stuff.
Used vinyl, I can understand. But a CD store in the mall? That's high rent.
I remember too, like, dude, that was the coolest job when I was like 13. And I never did. I was never cool enough to get hired by a record store to just, oh man, to hang out in a record shop all day. Yeah. I think that seemed like the dream job. And nobody, I was never hip enough. Jeans weren't the right color or whatever it was.
One of my first great jobs was at a bookstore in the mall here. And it was the bookstore in town that everybody went to. And it was right next door to the music store in town that everybody went to. And I was friends with them. And it was just such... you know, I was as close as I got to the music store.
Yeah, I worked at a bookstore too. Yeah. I'm bookstore cool, bro.
That makes two of us.
Tell you about Kurt Vonnegut novels. But you know what's funny? When I worked at the bookstore, the number one book was the Dr. Phil weight loss book. Like, I thought I was going to be doing, like, I'm going to be dealing with a more intelligent slice of society here. It's a bookstore. And then the number one book was a weight loss book by a man that was a little overweight. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I remember when I was working at the bookstore is when Oprah started her book club, and the first one was The Bridges of Madison County. And we sold like 1,000 copies in a week. Yeah. And it was like, what on earth is going on here?
I loved the Oprah book club, because it's just a matter of like, you know, you read some old book and then you want to talk to people about it. And people are like, yeah, I read that book in high school, bro. I don't remember. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it was actually like there'd be tons of people reading the same book at the same time. I really liked that aspect of
it. Did you watch Oprah?
No. Okay. I just, it was definitely
on the receiving end of it from the bookstore.
No, or I'd be riding the subway in New York and you would just see the same book. Like it just suddenly, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird would be everywhere or something.
Yeah,
that's
interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, and it would always be Oprah Book Club.
Okay, let's move on to your third song.
Okay. Oh, Ode to Billy Joe by Bobby Gentry. This was when I first moved to Florida, I took a Greyhound bus down here and just it was like a hellish ride from Pennsylvania. It takes like 2.5 days on a bus to get down. And when I got down here, My dad picked me up from the bus station, and I got on, or I got into his car, and got in, turned the car on, and just Ode to Billy Joe started playing. And I had never, ever heard it before. And I think, like, I grew up listening to oldies radio, but it's, I guess in the 50s, stuff was, like, a lot more regional. So you might have, a song that was a pretty big hit in, like, Georgia and Florida, but, like, wasn't a hit in New York City. Like, you know what I mean? And it wasn't all as connected. So I never once had heard this song and instantly knew it was, like, the subject matter was really, really strange. Not something people sang about. I mean, I could tell it was probably from, like, you know, the mid-60s to early 70s. You know, it has that vibe or whatever. And just subject was out of this world. The sound was way, way different. They used strings almost like sound effects in it. And I just, like, instantly remembered it. And I went home that night and tried to learn it. Just blew me away. And Bobby Gentry is, like, to this day, one of my musical heroes. She's such a cool, cool chick.
All right, let's hear it. This is Ode to Billy Joe by Bobby Gentry from her 1967 album of the same name. It's Dick Martin's third song on this episode of Three Song Stories.
It was the 3rd of June, another sleepy, dusty Delta day. I was out chopping cotton and my brother was baling hay. And at dinner time we stopped and walked back to the house to eat. And Mama hollered at the back door, y'all remember to wipe your feet. And then she said, I got some news this morning from Choctaw Ridge. Today Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. And Papa said to Mama as he passed around the black-eyed peas, well, Billy Joe never had a lick of sense. Pass the biscuits, please. There's 5 more acres in the lower 40 I got to plow. And Mama said it was a shame about Billy Joe anyhow. Seems like nothing ever comes to no good up on Choctaw Ridge. Just jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Brother said he recollected when he and Tom and Billy Joe put a frog down my back at the Carroll County Picture Show. And wasn't I talking to him after church last Sunday? Apple pie, you know it don't seem right. I saw him at the sawmill yesterday on Choctaw Ridge. And now you tell me Billy Joe's jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Mama said to me, child, what's happened to your appetite? Sunday. Oh, by the way, he said he saw a girl that looked a lot like you up on Choctaw Ridge. And she and Billy Joe was throwing something off the Tallahatchie Bridge. A year has come and gone since we heard the news about Billy Joe. They married Becky Thompson, they bought a store in Tupelo. There was a virus going round, Papa caught it and he died last spring. And now Mama doesn't seem to want to do much of anything. And me, I spend a lot of time picking flowers up on Choctaw Ridge and drop them into the muddy water off the Tallahatchie Bridge.
You know, you sent that to me. I didn't recognize the name. I didn't recognize the name Bobby Gentry at all. And then when I Googled it and I listened to it, I was like, I don't know where it took me back to, but it was certainly in my brain somewhere.
Yeah,
there's something about
yeah.
that very, you know, it's definitely got that weird woo.
It's almost like soundtrack style strings. Like it's something you hear in a movie soundtrack.
Yeah, from that era too, that late 60s.
Yeah, it's almost like James Bondy
yeah,
type
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But then the guitar is like this simple, like uncompressed, like little bluesy Dom 7th chord, just blam, 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 blam. I guess it's a tenor guitar or something too. She capos it. Yeah, so it's real kind of almost like small sounding, you know, which is such a strange arrangement, but just fascinating. I love that song. I love Bobby Gentry.
What else does she do? Or you know, where, how else
she
might I know her?
She does Fancy, which I think Reba McEntire covered at one point, maybe in like the early 80s. She also does a really good version of Son of a Preacher Man.
Lots of people know that song because Pulp Fiction and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you cover Ode to Billy Joe?
I cover Ode to Billy Joe. Because it's weird too. It's because it's specifically from a female point of view, which I don't do that many songs that are necessarily from a one point of view, really hardcore. But I just love it. And it's one of those songs too, of if I'm in a place and I play it and it's the type of atmosphere where people are like listening to the words, it knocks them dead. And I mean, not because I'm performing it so well. I mean, just because the words are so incredible to it. But if you're not, it's just like a nice little groovy tune in the background. You know what I mean? So, but I love covering that song.
You mentioned earlier that you book your band out 3 months as far as you can. Is your band you and other people? In the way you described your music to me, you kind of made it sound like you're a one-man show. Flesh out the band.
Yeah, I started using loopers and sequencers and drum machines and stuff like that. And I've always had a big interest in that stuff, but got to the point where, musicians are kind of unreliable, so I had to maybe have this drummer for a year and a half and things would be going really good. And just when I felt like he was getting good, he'd decide he was going to marry a girl and I'd get a new drummer, you know what I mean? And then you feel like you're taking such a step backwards for a long time. So I wanted to figure out ways to implement that stuff into the show to where if I had a bass player leave and I had a new guy come in, it wouldn't take so long. So now it's almost like we do everything where a lot of times it's just me solo, a lot of times it's me and a bass player, a lot of times it's me, bass player, and a drummer.
You got a band name?
Yeah, it's The Lower Middle Class.
The Lower Middle Class.
Yeah.
It's like
we wanted to be trying to figure out the most unpretentious name. Because if you're super poor, there's people romanticize if you're dirt poor, you know
yeah,
what I
yeah.
mean? They think that's hip. But lower middle class just seems so lame
it's
and white bread.
Tepid water.
Yeah, just so there's nobody romantic, nobody thinks the lower middle class is a cool place to be. So I don't know. Just wanted to find the most uncool name we could.
Where do you typically play up there?
Tonight we play at a place called, this will be out in a couple of weeks or something, right?
Yeah, that's okay.
So if
we
somehow can travel back in time, but most Thursdays we play at this place called 548 in St. Pete, and we really kind of open up in there and we play. It's a 5-hour show, so we really get to play for a long time.
Wow.
And it's weird where we're kind of a more electronic hip-hop kind of mood in there most of the time. We're a lot of times we're down on the beach, we're kind of a little bit more breezy. Down there, it kind of depends where we are, but 5-4, it gets pretty crazy. So we like going late and really loud in there. I mean, just any show that goes till 3 in the morning is going to be a little bit crazy.
Yeah, I would think. Do you spend a lot of time in the studio during the day? Do you sleep super late because you're playing super late gigs?
Yeah, I try to sleep as late as I can.
Dave's nodding.
Yeah, I try to. when you're,
was getting here at 3 o'clock in the afternoon from St. Pete, getting up early.
Yeah, a little bit. I shot for about
appreciate the
11. No, that's all right. That's all right. It's just something that goes till 3. By the time you're getting home and eating a little dinner, it's 6:30 in the morning, and But luckily, like my girlfriend is a server, so she usually works pretty late too.
Oh, so kind of on the same.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes I'm out a little bit before she is. Sometimes she's out a little bit before I am. But you know.
Music that you've recently discovered that you are into that you think you might pass along to our listeners because they wouldn't have heard of it.
Ooh, like brand new stuff that's dropping right now?
Not necessarily. If you found something that's off the beaten path that still might not be in people's minds.
One kid, and I guess, I don't know how long, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's, overnight successes are usually around for 20 years, you know what I mean? But there's this kid, Hobo Johnson, that's great. He's like this chubby rapper kid, and I've only seen a video or two, but like his band just seems like they're playing on like toys that you buy from Walmart, just weird little drum pads and stuff. But the kid just, I don't know, like raps about his parents.
What's his name again? Hobo?
Hobo Johnson. He like raps about his parents getting divorced and things like that. And it's, I mean, it's very juvenile. That's why I love it though. There's, you know, it's not trying to be more mature than it is. It's just, it's a kid being a kid. And it feels authentic, I guess. But like I've only seen a video or two, but that stuff seems really, really great.
Is there anything super mainstream that you like?
What was that? I mean, he's been underground for a minute, but now Childish Gambino.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, oh my God, Redbone from last year, and then This Is America. I mean, it's not often that any is that political and that mainstream. Like that rarely happens anymore. You know, most of this stuff is pretty bubblegum, which I'm fine with too. I love, you know, pop music. That's fine, but for just something to have that much, you know, political weight behind it, and then still be like a hit song. It's pretty rare now. Hmm. So that guy is just on fire. Atlanta's brilliant. Donald Glover, I guess is his real name, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
you know,
good.
I had somebody on this show, you know, I don't know, about a month ago when that song first hit, and I asked him that same question. He said, you know, Childish Gambino. And I said, I don't know who you're talking about. He's like, and he kept explaining it, because I don't really listen to popular music.
No,
really.
Yeah, sure.
And suddenly I was like, oh, I know what you're talking about because I heard a story about it on NPR. So that's how close I get to pop music is I hear people talk about it.
You know, my thing is like I'll see like parodies of stuff. Sometimes it'll be some popular movie that I don't see, but I've seen four parodies about it. So like I pretty much have seen that movie. Yeah. I get the gist. Childish Gambino, Donald Glover, anything that guy puts out that I've heard seems really, really smart and really well produced and really well thought out. And he's just – I mean, Atlanta's like the best show on TV. He's running the best show and dropping the best music.
So and he's Lando Calrissian.
Yeah, I haven't actually seen that yet, but that's pretty hip. That's a, you know, that's a great get if you're an actor.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, it was really refreshing for me because not knowing who on earth he is or was, I had no baggage for when I saw Solo. You know what I mean? Like I wasn't oh, that's the guy from Atlanta or that's...
Yeah.
I had no baggage. And so I really could see Lando in him, which was nice.
Yeah. Sometimes you kind of take previous roles into stuff with you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's definitely nice. But yeah, he's super smart. And I heard that like back in the 90s, he went to some website and it was like hip hop name generator and you would like press a button and just like random words would pop up and he pressed the button. The first thing that popped up was Childish Gambino, which I think like, you know, a really childish gangster. That's most hip hop music, right?
Yeah,
like
no,
that's,
yeah, that's,
I'm just like, yeah,
that's
yeah.
Perfect.
So yeah, I always thought that was a pretty funny name to go with, you know. I can't get enough of that stuff. And the This Is America video specifically.
Yeah, yeah.
Really,
I have now since
really
been
good.
Gone and looked at it, all the different layers.
Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah
so good. So the SNL performance of it was really, really good. And it was mostly just like a couple of kids dancing. It wasn't anything like over the top with effects or anything. But I don't know. So keeping an eye on that guy.
Last question. Is there any song that you will always turn off if you are exposed to it via the radio or something for whatever reason?
yeah, just like Barracuda. I cannot stand Barracuda, Magic Man, any of that. Like I get like late 70s kind of female sung stadium rock. I can't jive with any of it.
What about the Bangles?
I like the Bangles. Walk Like an
That's
Egyptian,
a whole different
Manic
vibe,
Monday.
Though. That's a whole different
but that
vibe.
Was like pop, the pop music version of punk. I it's weird. I had Bangles. I had a weird toy as a child that took toy cassettes, and one of the toy cassettes played like the first half of Walk Like an Egyptian.
Okay, well, that is all the time that we have. Do you have any final thoughts here, Mr. Martin?
Just, thank you guys so much for having me. I appreciate being in.
We make Three Song Stories in the WGCU studios on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Richard Chinqui is our show's co-creator and producer. Tara Callaghan is our online content producer. Our executive producer is Chris Duffus. Our theme music was created by Stick Martin and Dave Cowan at Monkey House Studio in St. Pete. And today's show was directed by Dave Cowan. Okay, you out there in podcast land, we want to hear from you. Pick a song that brings you back to a story from your life. Write out that story and email it to mysongstory@wgcu.org. We will then contact you and help you record your story so we can use it as a parting tune at the end of a future episode. For my parting tune this week, I'm going back to the early 2000s. I was actually reminded of this song because of the From Vinyl recording of Styx's first song, Ode to Billy Joe, because it was digitized straight from vinyl. It had the clicks and pops you'd get from an album. Well, that brought me back to an album that I often used to play as background music during parties because it was just so weird and groovy. And because I had recorded it from an LP, it also had the old school clicks and pops. The album is called Jazz Raga. It was recorded live in 1966 by a Hungarian guitarist named Gábor Szabó. Sorry, Gábor, if I got that wrong. This is one of the covers it contained, if you can believe it, Paint It Black by the Rolling Stones. When I hear this song or anything off this album, I will never be able to resist traveling back in time to our little house along the river in North Fort Myers that was destroyed by Hurricane Charlie, and the good times that were constantly afoot there, until Charlie, with something like this song spinning in the background. I'm Mike Canary. Keep listening. Thank you.
Next time on Three Song Stories.
And that was intense, you know, on the lawn and lots of mud and people sliding around. And, you know, and then we had, you know, the freak show on the side where people had all the piercings and lifting, you know, things with certain body parts that weighed a lot of, you know, a lot of weight.